When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So for me, in a book like Dissident Gardens, the idea that you're a vessel of this gigantic, intangible movement that's happening, that you are part of a revolution, even if no one else will believe you, that it's about to come, to me, that's as tripped out as any fantastic vision I could ever have offered.
Hi, I'm Raihan Salam, and this is the Vice Podcast. I'm joined today by Jonathan Lethem, author, most recently, of Dissident Gardens. Jonathan, thanks very much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Were you always a storyteller?
Maybe at some level, but I was a visual artist first. My father is a painter. He's still making art. Actually, I was with him yesterday looking at some slides of his new work. And I grew up thinking I was going to make sculptures, paintings, drawings, and doing it, making a lot of them. So the storytelling kind of snuck in under the radar.
I wonder, so in the household, was this a thing where the implements for the making of art were just present, they were just part of the scene, and so you gravitated to them naturally?
I grew up, you know, wanting to get into my dad's studio, the way the grown-up stuff seems cool to you. And some of my early, home movies show me, you know, painting on his walls. Yeah, it was very natural. And, you know, there were books around, too. We were a house full of kind of cultural stuff. And certainly I was taking in stories and thinking about stories in a lot of different ways, too. But what I conceived when I first wanted to create something was all along the lines of what was most obvious to me, which was to draw. And I was kind of good at it. I inherited a facility. I could impress the grown-ups with my little drawing. So I had every encouragement to do that.
Were you impressing them with the faithfulness of the drawing? Was it that you were drawing renderings that just seemed really, stylish, but also, kind of accurate? Or was it more?
Well, I could do life observation, and I was pretty good at it. But I think also, I was inventive and expressive with the materials, which was how my father painted. He could do a life drawing, but he tended in his paintings, in his serious work, to make things, he was an expressionist. It was visionary. It had some distorted or imagined element as well. And so I was doing both of those things.
So you grew up in a household in which culture, broadly understood, was a central preoccupation. Did your parents come from a universe in which that had also been true?
Well, they both fought themselves into that space, I think, in different ways. My mother's upbringing had been very oriented towards higher education, and books were revered. But she dropped out of college and kind of ran away to the Greenwich Village folk scene. So she was, dabbling with counterculture before there was a counterculture, or when it was only a nascent one. And my father, in a way, was even more of a black sheep. He came from a large Midwestern family that, didn't really know what art was, or didn't have any close relationship to it. And he somehow conceived this life for himself, and moved to New York and studied painting at Columbia and became part of that world, which New York was where it was at.
So it's neat to think about how they wrested themselves from their familiar environs and from what had been a source of stability to thrust themselves into this different world. And then you're born into this milieu that feels, you know, pretty open and encouraging of creativity.
Huge head start for me.
But was it a head start, or was it actually not a head start?
Absolutely. No, I mean, when I compare notes with other writers, I think so many people have to fight for the, just to believe that it's something that normal people do, that they can choose to do, you know. And for me, that world of, you know, deciding to make art was never esoteric or remote. It was always sort of like, sure, okay, your father goes into the studio every day, you know, no one... He doesn't need permission. He's not even necessarily always getting a lot of attention for it or getting paid for it. But it's a choice you can make. You're allowed. And I just took it as a given. So I didn't have to make that leap of self-invention from as far a distance, I guess, as a lot of artists do.
Disciplined Gardens is a book about utopians of various stripes and also, you know, in some cases, very militant, very serious utopians who are kind of think of themselves as leftists, think of themselves as part of this larger family. And I wonder, I mean, it sounds that you grew up in a kind of bohemian, open, culturally minded milieu, but would you say that there was any kind of resonance between these kinds of environments?
Yeah, no, I grew up in a family that thought of itself as activists, and I went to demonstrations when I was a kid, and you know, took it for granted that there was always sort of a very strong point of view on any contemporary issue. You know, I mean, when I first came of age, I'm old enough now, I can remember the Vietnam War and when we were still, you know, in a way, our like daily life was saturated with this belief that we were living in opposition to this, you know, thing that our government was doing. So, yeah, it's very much a part of my bloodstream.
One thing I find interesting about this is that, so being saturated in an oppositional culture, I mean, there's something funny about that because the discourse of the oppositional culture assumes that there's some kind of mainstream that exists in the world, and yet you're in this milieu where that mainstream isn't really asserting itself. It isn't really running your life.
Well, I grew up with all kinds of very vibrant and very, you know, dense marginal identities. Partly the structure of the city, you know, being from Brooklyn and Manhattan was over there, but then also, you know, knowing, being able to grasp at a certain point that New York was a special condition, you know, that it wasn't typical of American identity in every way. It was very important to it, but it wasn't the, you know, the average. It wasn't typical. And I learned this because we would go to the Midwest to visit my father's relatives. I had this big extended family, you know, kind of scattered around the middle of the country.
Is this more the kind of Lutheran, German, kind of northern Midwest?
Protestant Scottish background, but, you know, very 5-6 generations in, very much a part of the heartland.
Kind of bleak northerly landscapes.
Well, yeah, just the prairie, you know. It wasn't the Great Lakes Midwest. It was Iowa and Missouri. So prairie, you know, farmland, acres of corn, and, you know, basically, my uncles, my father's brothers, all kind of went into business of various kinds.
It's neat that those ties weren't severed. It's neat that actually, despite, you know, the fact that your father obviously went in a very different direction, he felt connected.
Oh, yeah,
to
no.
Landscape.
I mean, in terms of the familial connection, he was never disaffected from his family. He'd made choices that fascinated them, but it's a very warm, still is, a very warm, embracing, sprawling family with a lot of different kinds of outliers in it. So, you know, my dad was just one of those, but there was never a sense of a rupture, and I'm very grateful for that. It means that, you know, compared to people with the kinds of affiliations that I wear on my sleeve, the kinds that people recognize in me, like being a New Yorker, you know, being a bohemian, growing up, you know, well, not religiously Jewish, but in kind of the cultural Jewish stuff of New York, that people typically look at me and think, oh, well, you don't know anything about what Missouri is like. Well, actually, I know a whole lot about it, and that has been a gift for me. But, I was very conscious of being from strong marginal positions would be the way to put it, And that the counterculture, in the years that I was first coming into consciousness, the 60s, early 70s, felt so unified. It did it anyway to a kid. It felt like one big giant thing that was, you know, it was the age of Aquarius. We were changing the world, and it was going to continue forever that way. So when...
It's amazing that you were so cognizant of this stuff. I mean, because you were obviously quite small.
But, couldn't have articulated it at the time. But, you know, by the time I was 11, 12, 13, I mean, I remember when Nixon was reelected in 72. And what a jolt it was to me, because I couldn't imagine what kind of human being was voting for Nixon. But it was a landslide, you know. The other side had been humiliated, and then I had to sort of reframe and begin to understand that where I was from culturally was only one sample.
Did it feel frightening? I mean, just the thought of, you know, thinking of yourself as being in this strong position, this unified larger culture of people who are making positive change, kind of lionizing your own parents, even if only implicitly, and the world of which they were a part, and then suddenly having this shock, and this takes you outside of that.
Well, you know, every kid kind of thinks his family is the entire world for a while, and every kid, no matter what their family is like culturally or politically, how normative or how eccentric, has to start to make that triangulation. Oh, like, wait a minute, my parents are really specific, and not everyone's like that, and there's a big world out there, and I could even, like, sample from some of the other stuff. But no, I wasn't threatened when I understood my parents weren't in the total majority. I got it, but I was prone, as they were, as, you know, as people in the counterculture who, you know, who weren't children, who were just true believers. You know, when Reaganism comes along and the 70s rolls into the 80s, and some parts of what had happened got so vilified, and there was such a powerful rollback, what we now call the culture wars, right? And but also, in putting aside like cultural signifiers, just in real economic terms, that, you know, we weren't going to be an egalitarian society, that the kind of the FDR, Lyndon Johnson, you know, great society, you know, that we would end up here where we are with this like nightmarish, you know, 1%, the disparity between the rich and poor being so grotesque as it is now.
I also wonder about the fraying of the world of self-governing communities, mm-hmm. you know, the communes that people formed. And well, so, because I wonder if that's kind of a parallel discourse. You know, when you think about the history of the kibbutzim in Israel, right. You know, to some degree, you know, it starts out with this tremendous high-mindedness. And then there are just these deep questions about how does a family work, and intimacy, right. and safety and security. And you wonder if this historical drama you're describing, there was a parallel drama of people realizing that these utopias they were building were disappointing.
Oh, sure. I mean, utopia is a very insupportable notion by definition. It's like beautiful to reach for it, and it's prone to these kind of fractional, you know, conflicts, and to just collapse under the weight of wishful thinking, under the weight of what reality, undertow of reality, the way reality is always humbling our visions for ourselves and for our families and societies with all kinds of hard lessons. But I also think that, you know, something you just were bumping against there in that question, I mean, is a really huge change and a really hard one to define, but I think it's everywhere, is the slow incremental loss of the idea of the commons. You know, forget communes or kibbutzes or any other specific utopian experiment, but what about the great American utopian experiment of a society that included, you know, things like the highway system or the post office or parklands, things that weren't corporatized, weren't privatized, there wasn't a fast lane for the rich people to go on, that we've watched this very steady incremental destruction of the idea of a commons in our society.
I also wonder how this relates to the idea of inclusion. And one of the central preoccupations of your work has been actually reaching outside of mm-hmm. your narrow experience, but to think about people for example, you know, growing up in Brooklyn in an environment where you have this community of Bohemians, most of whom were white, and then you have this community of blacks, and these were both groups were migrants, yeah. and these were both people who had been displaced in various ways, and then this juxtaposition,
right.
and then this idea of how do we knit together some kind of common community.
Yeah.
And, you know, one thing I wonder about when you're talking about, you know, this idea of the commons and of shared community, reconciling that with the fact that different people are going to have different relationships to these larger categories of the mainstream or mm-hmm. bohemia or whatever else, rooted in these different kinds of defensiveness and whatever else. I mean, I wonder, did you start detecting that tension early in life? And was this something?
Well, maybe subconsciously. I mean, you know, or I just couldn't have named any of that stuff. But I think that, you know, the idea of inclusion, the idea of participation, the idea of community was, you know, was thrust, being engaged with this stuff was kind of thrust on me. Because the neighborhood I grew up in was such a crossroads. You know, I mean, speaking of a commons, well, not by design, but just by historical accident, where I was from was a neighborhood that had no definite, you know, bottom line identity. It wasn't like this place was, you know, an enclave of, let's say, Puerto Ricans or anything in any original sense. It was a place that was being, you know, claimed at different times by different people, and it was always under sort of negotiation. You know, what is this block going to be like? What's this one going to be like? Who does it belong to? What's its social temperature? What's its economic reality? And I came to see, you know, it as a microcosm of, obviously, you know, you could take it as an allegory of some sort of pure American experience, because, right, who does this place belong to?
Yeah, and just the constant ways of displacement.
Yeah.
There's this neat book. It's very jargony. It's very dense, but it's called The Invention of Brownstone Brooklyn, and one of the things that's most striking about it, and it actually ends in the late 70s, and it talks about the idea that what you had this space mm-hmm. called South Brooklyn,
right.
and then at the end of it, you have, you know, Borum Hill, you have Carroll Gardens, yeah. et cetera, but that actually the space was actually super local. It really was about street to street, block to block.
Absolutely.
And there was kind of
these things were being
kind of
designed by individuals. I mean, I growing up, I knew the woman who made up the name Borum Hill and began offering it to people as the, you know, the way to understand this set of blocks that they were living on, and
the idea of inventing a tradition, you know, kind of the idea of something, this is our historical identity.
But also by implication, it was a partition. It was saying, therefore, you here should feel differently and feel separated from the people on the other side of this line that we're drawing, which, as you point out, didn't exist before.
It seems like an amazing education to have, in a way. So that, I mean, so actually when you encounter this now, when you encounter that landscape and how much it's changed and how central mm-hmm. this slice of Brooklyn that was, you know, part of your upbringing has become to the American imagination. How does...
It's peculiar. Yeah, I think I ended up by weird luck, I mean, not to claim my experience as sort of like, exceptional one, but in terms of writing or documenting that particular neighborhood, I accidentally became the last of the old Brooklyn writers and the first of the new. I was like a watershed in the sense that the idea of, you know, when I grew up, if you read about Brooklyn in fiction or if you just put your ear to the street and listened to the mythos, it was all about, you know, getting out. It was basically a place that you wanted to kind of find a way to graduate from. It was like this, you know, swamp of ethnic immigrant experience where you kind of pulled yourself off and pushed the muck away and then got across the bridge and made yourself into something. I mean, we all know this myth from things as elemental as like Saturday Night Fever, right? You know, like crossing the bridge becomes this big episode, where life could be different. You don't have to be bogged down with the old expectations of the old neighborhood. And the fact that it's such a destination now and so
it's amazing also when you think about the slice of historical time we're talking about, because mm-hmm. you think about the teens and the 20s, you have people in these teeming tenements, they empty out, you come to Brooklyn, you have breathing room, and yet suddenly, within the space, in the imagination of the larger imagination, and also in lived reality, it becomes the shtetl. You know what I mean? Or it just becomes, you know, this kind of place of ethnic enclaves and sort of this kind of tight control. And then that unraveling, and then the idea of it becoming a destination or something like that.
Yeah. So, I mean, but it also, the pace of change, I mean, the stuff that I isolated when I was writing really directly about that gentrification is already itself ancient history. I mean, the things that have happened economically to, well, Borum Hill specifically in the last 5 years, it's changed as much again as it did in the period of time that I was trying to, you know, put my brain around. It's gaudy now. I mean, it's been taken to an absurd level where the houses are, you know, all filled with movie stars because it's become like a fetish to live there. And that's different. That's different again from just an ordinary gentrification.
Because Dissident Gardens begins in Queens, and it begins in an apartment complex that was very much a redoubt of the left, I want to know a little bit about your map of New York from this earlier period of your life. Because I imagine, you know, being a Brooklyn kid, I mean, Queens was this different animal, and it was obviously kind of a congeries, it was a kind of like a mishmash. But what was your sense of Queens? Because it seems like it's kind of this alternate place, right? Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, having written about this environment with which you are more familiar, I wonder about your sense of Queens.
Well, I went there in a very specific way. I went to Sunnyside, which is the place I've written about, because my grandmother lived there. So I saw it through her eyes, and I took it into my body, and even in ways that I couldn't define, but just as on her terms. And she had a very proprietary, chip on the shoulder kind of air to her. You know, she loved the city, and she was very proud of her identity as a New Yorker. She also found Queens, I think, kind of mawkish and embarrassing in certain ways. And she was, just as a very specific example, she was adamant that neither my mother nor none of the grandchildren would ever have like a New York accent. She mocked the kind of street, you know, the deep Queens or deep Brooklyn accent that you might hear. In, you know, what she wanted to do was, in a way, renovate, you know, her private experience and Manhattanize her private experience, even if she was in this suburban precinct. But, you know, speaking as someone who's, you know, intentionally and also inadvertently just absorbed a lot of the history and the underlying kind of, I'm not sure what to call it, you know, gestalt or mythos of New York City, there's a really, really big difference between Brooklyn identity and Queens identity. And that is that Brooklyn was a rival city with a separate center and a separate self-definition. Now, it might not have thought, you know, it was at that time would have been called New York. It might not have thought that it was the full equal to New York City, which was Manhattan. But it was nevertheless autonomous and very defiant and very proud and had its own institutions, you know, its own, political corruption, its own,
its own great historical society,
its own historical museum, its own museum, its own great restaurants, its own everything. And then it was partitioned. You know, it's almost like a Palestinian territory or something. You know, it becomes absorbed and humbled in, you know, in what was probably a rigged election, right?
300 votes.
Yeah. So there's this broken but still defiant autonomous identity that is Brooklyn.
You said that so wonderfully. I have to say, this really means a lot to me to hear you say that.
Thank you. And even for people who don't know this story and haven't heard this story, I think that DNA of that grievance is part of Brooklyn's legacy if you grow up there. And it reproduces itself in certain ways so that when, you know, for instance, in the 50s, the Dodgers leave, which is a story many more people are familiar with, it's like we was robbed. You know, there's this sense that Brooklyn is a place that where a greatness was stolen from it. And Queens has none of this difficulty in relationship to its identity, to the greatness of the city as a whole. It's because it never is proposed as a rival. It's essentially a giant bedroom community. It's the first suburb, you know? And Queens makes itself in its relation to, you know, being the place where the workers live, that feeds and nourishes and, you know, empties the ashtrays, and the subway system is designed so that you just scoot in and out and, you know, it doesn't cluster around. You know, in Brooklyn, you see the subways all gnarled together around Borough Hall. There's the old city center is still still being written in the subway map. In Queens, you just have these long lines, very evenly spaced, designed to make the suburb accessible and functional. And, you know, it's also, it's a developer's scam. The subway in Queens tells another story, which is that people sold those farmlands, you know, in private deals to people who were who knew where the subway was going to be. You know, someday there'll be something here, but they were building subway stations in what was essentially swampland or farmland. You know, and then the people arrived subsequently. So it's not like they're servicing an existing city; they're making one. They're declaring this space and saying what it's going to be. So Queens is kind of homely in its and subsidiary in its deep, you know, deep relation to the city at large, and it has this spatial quality. You know, things happen there because of the.
Polycentric. I mean, I think that's
it's polycentric, yeah. But it's also its distinctive features all have to do with what you can do if you're planning something while it's still all wide open spaces. So you end up with the World's Fair, and you end up with Flushing Meadows, and you end up with these giant cemeteries, you know, which you can't squirrel those kinds of things into an existing city. You know, Brooklyn and Manhattan were already too densely constructed. But if you're planning a place from scratch, you can allocate these giant.
And then there are the interstices
zones.
And the things that kind of
grow around
them.
The airports is another one.
Absolutely. You know? The classic kind of marginal or liminal kind of, you know. I wonder, when you were talking about your grandmother and her cultural aspirations, or rather her cultural standards and the rigor of those standards.
Yeah.
I wonder about this kind of high culture egalitarianism, you know, because it's kind of...
It's very tricky.
Yeah, so you're talking about people who are very connected to these very romantic ideas about the working class and about inclusion and about the idea of bridging divides and the idea of the artificiality of these divides. And yet also there's obviously this kind of exclusion and cultural
elitism,
capital being...
Yeah. And a snobbery. Well, one way to understand this is as a secular mirror to Jewish tribal identity, which is the people of the book, elevated, you know, deeply concerned with justice and fairness, but, you know, obsessed also with social hierarchy and with making oneself better, you know, becoming the doctors and the lawyers, with elites, and considering itself an elite by dint of its commitment to these ideals, which is a tricky, you know, a tricky stew once you try to transfer it to a belief in the people, right?
Did your parents think of themselves as upwardly mobile, downwardly mobile in a romantic kind of way, or did they not think in those terms?
They wouldn't have thought in those terms. I mean, my parents, I think, they wouldn't have identified with the term bohemian, which I think somehow was, you know, in their generation, in the 50s, it was, you know, suggested somehow like a code word for something kind of decadent or, you know, possibly homosexual kind of deliberate fae or cultivated.
Or also perhaps not sufficiently political.
Well, certainly not political. Bohemianism doesn't sound political. And it sounds sort of put on, like a kind of, you know, velvet slippers or something. But in fact, I mean, I think that's the right word for the way they lived their lives. They were what they identified with was that they were artists and activists. And the commitment to a life, both making art and being on the front lines of protest, simply dictated what, I guess somebody might have called downward mobility of a certain kind. But they weren't coming down from that far, you know? I mean, what they were really were anti-authoritarian. Because for people like my parents, the obvious avenue for self-improvement, I mean, they weren't going to become doctors or lawyers, and they weren't going to become wealthy by any other terms unless you know, my father had the rare luck of becoming a famous artist, which is, you know, he might have liked to, but it doesn't happen to very many people. But the way that people very much like my parents normally stabilize, gentrify, enter the, let's say, the secure middle class is through academia. My mother was a college dropout, but she was one of those literate people I or anyone ever met. Very, very much the type who would have flourished if she'd stayed in college and given herself that kind of typical opportunity. And my father was specifically a college professor. I mean, he'd gotten his master's. He was a Fulbright scholar. And in Kansas City, teaching at the Kansas City Art Institute, he basically lost his tenure-track teaching position over his commitment to the students against Vietnam. They needed a faculty representative in order to become an official campus student society. You needed one co-signee who was on the faculty. He gave himself to that and then began counseling his draft-eligible students to run away to Canada and lost his job. And from then on, he worked as, you know, he was still painting, but he worked as a carpenter and, you know, sometimes did teaching, but only in marginal ways. He taught in prisons. He taught at youth centers. So he had been on track to be a college professor. He was one. So it was their anti-authoritarianism or anti-institutionalism that exiled them from the way that people very much like them would have tended to enter the middle class. A very typical decision, of course, in their generation. There were lots of dropouts. I mean, it was a social movement to throw over, you know, to see even academia as insufferably bureaucratic and institutional, not something you could abide with.
Well, it's also just the precedents that were created and the way that new hierarchies arise out of these new ways of life. That's what's so striking, because you think about these, you know, an elite research institution, mm-hmm. and then looking at this moment and then trying to capitalize it on it in various ways, or just thinking that, you know, let's lionize these figures who are these dissidents, right. and then let's just assimilate them completely into right. this, and then, like, you know, let's give them markers, those who are sufficiently successful, let's give them markers of prestige, and then yeah. reassert our legitimacy somehow. So, you know, I think that...
It creates this paradox, right? Are the mm-hmm. tenured radicals of the generation sort of just following my father's era of involvement in academia, is that great generation of tenured radicals who are teaching everyone now and defining the temper of so many institutions still, but was that like a giant buy-off? Were they defanged by being incorporated into
So these... you went to college. I mean, and you...
Well, I dropped out. Actually, I took their example I didn't think of it as, I'm going to be just like them. Although, my mother's defiance about never finishing college was certainly, it was an available, you know, model for me. But no, I did. I was, you know, a lot of ways I reproduced their MO.
Did you start with high hopes? Did you start with some?
No, I think I got into college. First of all, I was still a painter. I got into college with a portfolio of examples of my artwork.
And you went to a famously experimental...
And I went to an eccentric school that I thought was going to be accommodating to my fitful relationship to... You know, I'd already been indulged in a way, because I went to high school of music and art in New York City, and I was a success in my art classes and sort of in my English classes as well, because I liked books, but I stopped taking math or science at a certain point, and I got away with it. So there weren't that many colleges I could have gotten into, and Bennington seemed to me to be, maybe it would, you know, be accommodating. But the thing that happened to me going to Bennington was that I thought I was going to an art school for freaks like me, but I found that I was at a school for the rich children, the black sheep of private school families, whose other, you know, their siblings were all at, you know, Harvard or Brown or Yale, and these were the druggies and the artists and very interesting students. I mean, lots of people who I still know and like, but there was a general atmosphere of privilege that was really alien to me and alienating. I think I'd managed to avoid confronting the real truth about how much privilege was out there.
When I think about Black identity in New York right now, I think about this huge foreign-born share of the Black population, huge Haitian population, mm-hmm. West African population, et cetera. It's just enormously diverse. And separate from that diversity in terms of national origin, foreign-born, et cetera, you have this other parallel diversity of new identities, kind of, post-60s, post-70s. Mm-hmm. And just the idea of having the freedom to be many different things. Whereas in Distant Gardens, you portray this slice of Black New York mm-hmm. rubbing up against this slice of, I guess, leftist or bohemian, non-Black, white New York. And I wonder, so you devoted years to researching this book, and mm-hmm. I wonder just kind of your thoughts about that universe of the Black New York that existed, during these decades you describe in the novel. And how that's...
Well, the culture of, of color, as I came to know it, was so deeply, deeply defined by the civil rights movement. Growing up in the late 60s and early 70s, there was this, the essential argument could be encapsulated in the shift in energy from, a Martin Luther King model or a Jackie Robinson model to a Malcolm X, Black Panther, Eldridge Cleaver model. But it was about this idea, you also had it in the popular culture, that there was a Black experience. You felt it in the presence of someone like, Bill Cosby, or the behavior of the Black athletes at the Olympics in the 70s, that there was just a really definite thing that had come into its own and exposed a very raw edge and was very, had needed a kind of a leg up from liberal and often very specifically Jewish, alliances, but that was now, the James Brown song, "I don't want nobody to give me nothing, open up the door, I'll get it myself." This idea that, certain Black performers or institutions were going to make themselves all Black, No thank you, I'm going to do it myself. And
so this is unfolding when you were a thinking person.
You're
an early adolescent, you're seeing this happen.
And, I also think that one of the things I felt by the time I'd finished writing The Fortress of Solitude, that I understood about the, this is very true in Dissident Gardens, that, when you're contemplating the 20th century in American life and the accomplishments of various revolutions or liberation movements or social movements for social justice or equality, they're always so distressingly both a giant victory and a giant defeat. And the way that the civil rights era became this story that I grew up believing that my family was like an emblem of championing this happening and it was so great, and now we were all going to live together and it was all going to be great.
Emblem of civil rights and social justice and the idea of bridging divides.
Yeah, absolutely. My parents had been at the March on the Mall. I'd been there in utero myself. I was born a few months later, right? It was my first Dylan gig. But that we were part of a story that included our Black neighbors, and that they understood that and we understood that. And then by the time of the 70s and when I'm in school with kids from the projects, knowing in a way, of course I couldn't have articulated it, it took me 30 years to even begin to define the questions, let alone have answers for them, that their lives were still distressingly separate and that my options were so much larger automatically, and that, poverty was accomplishing so much of what the Jim Crow laws had been in place to accomplish without the help of the laws, that there was an underclass, and it was so extensively black, and that this wasn't going to change because of all our good intentions or congratulating ourselves for, you know, having a, you know, black people in baseball or on our television set, that wasn't the same thing as the lives of all the people that I was in school with, but I was still so separate from in terms of trajectories and opportunities and self possibilities for self-definition and self-invention, that the promises were so disastrously, you know, the promises of the civil rights movement were so unkept as well as, you know, manifest.
It's also interesting just to think about how oppressive that idea of a shared identity can be, not to everyone, but to some. Mm-hmm. And just the idea that, and the responsibility that flows from the idea of solidarity. Because, you know, my broad sense is that when you look at the landscape of early 21st century America, you are not necessarily delighted by the inequality and whatever else. You certainly don't sound particularly stoked about it, one might say. But, you know, another way of looking at it is that when you think about the fragmentation of some of these identities, and you think about the demands of solidarity, mm-hmm. and the idea of being liberated from some of those demands and being able to carve out a different kind of space and what that means in terms of subjective human freedom. And it just, you know, because I wonder, you know, one of your characters, to be a black police officer with a family, a police officer of all things, and the burden of that, and then to make this break, I wonder where the inspiration for that came from. I don't even mean in any biographical sense, but just I mean sort of in terms of...
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that I became very identified really powerfully with, I guess, you know, the singer in The Fortress of Solitude is another one of these characters, the generation of black men who would have been the fathers of my friends and who were... given this in the 50s, early 60s, given this opportunity to claim full, they were told they were being given the opportunity, you know, sort of the Jackie Robinson moment, right, to assume adulthood in this new society, and how devastating so many of those lives were because of the legacy they'd grown up inside, and the perplexities of what was still incomplete, what is still incomplete. And yet, you know, we're talking about people like James Brown or Richard Pryor or, you know, or the anyone in the generation, in the government, you know, the Colin Powells or you know, or a police officer in New York City, who aspires to be more than a beat cop, you know, like my character, but becomes a lieutenant and becomes, you know, a figure of authority, even as he walks down a given street in Queens or anywhere in the city, probably, and absorbs the hatred and disdain of, you know, mediocre, you know, human types who nonetheless believe they can basically lorded over any black person. And he has to somehow conjure up the dignity to invest in the authority that his job awards him, but it's like a daily construction job to take that role, to take that place, to shrug off the legacy.
And the exhaustion.
And the exhaustion, yeah. And then, yeah, you know, so he's a character that means a lot to me. He's, you know, he's almost the loneliest character in the whole book, and it's a book with a lot of lonely characters in it. Because then, of course, what he discovers is that the way so many of his fellow black policemen have accommodated to the almost unbearable pressures and paradoxes is by becoming corrupt policemen. Well, that's hardly, you know, unique. It was very, very widespread corruption in the in the NYPD. You have stories like Serpico that tell you about how lonely it would be to stand in opposition to that culture. And so, you know, he tries to divide himself from the being enmeshed in the kind of conspiracy of being on the pad, as they would call it back then, or on the take.
And his son is someone who, in many respects, achieves this kind of esteem that's offered to someone who enters the institutions, mm-hmm. who gets an Ivy League degree.
Right.
And so, you know, this kind of esteem that was just out of reach, that seemed to be this promise is realized mm-hmm. in the next generation.
Yeah.
And yet it's not.
Well, yeah, his son faces the horrible crossroads of realizing that no matter how articulate, how indignant, how prideful his intellectual, you know, identity can be, and he's, you know, he's a kind of a commanding intellect, and takes shit from no one, but his function institutionally is as a kind of almost like a good luck charm when he thinks of it in the worst possible way. He's a talisman of otherness, you know, and I don't think this is easy to resolve.
And the indignity that flows from that sense of not being treated as a person, but rather as a talisman. I wonder about you as a writer and how you think about bodies. Mm-hmm. Specifically, you know, so the character we were just discussing, Cicero, he is fat.
Yeah.
And just as someone who is tuned into hierarchies, I wonder, when you look at the way that our culture has changed, one thing I'm struck by, at least, is that there is an opportunity, there is permeability for some people who have the right kind of body. You think of that. Now, the crudest way of putting this is that there are certain physiognomies that, you know, for example, if you're black, if you're a person of you know, with a dark complexion, certain physiognomies that might nevertheless be seen as appealing, you know, kind of when you have this kind of Euro-normative kind of frame of mind. And I just kind of wonder about, is that something that's, and obviously someone who's visual, you know?
Yeah, sure. No, I think about this stuff all the time. I mean, one of my great, you know, obsessions is the idea that we everywhere congratulate ourselves for our sophistication and our diversity and our, you know, kind of postmodern irony and cynicism and jadedness, but actually we're extremely innocent and Victorian and deeply conformist culture right now in many ways, with this like kind of veneer of sophistication that is the enabling, you know, gauze that we peer at ourselves through.
You reproduce the hierarchies, you reinforce the hierarchies.
Of course, they're so
you recruit
powerful.
Those who fit naturally into them. Yeah.
And then at the same time, you asked about bodies, and I do think about the great, let's you know, act as if we all know what this is. It's been, you know, discussed in various frameworks, but the great Jewish-Black alliance at some point breaks down along a very raw physical, crossroads, where the Jews can assimilate to whiteness and the blacks can't. The bodies say, we're not in this together anymore, which is weird. You know, it's like, don't act like I have your option to assimilate. So, of course, I guess, you know, Cicero's heaviness, you know, I wanted to make him as obstreperous and as impossible to get a frame around as could be, for himself and for the reader. He's like a big problem. So it's a way of manifesting the bigness of what a problem he is, right? And I think about this a lot. The feeling as different, as much a dissident, as alienated as I do, and yet having, you know, I mean, right now I'm I'm dressed in certain ways that demarcate that I'm not like a businessman, right? And I've got my little stubble. But I mean,
it's almost official. It's almost a theory.
Maybe, yeah, maybe. But I could also, you know, go to Brooks Brothers and get a razor, and I could probably stroll into, you know, I mean, my otherness is not born by my body. Whatever I identify with or however I feel in relation to the society at large, I'm not saddled with, you know, that experience. And yet I think about it all the time. So I guess I made a character who claims, you know, about five different kinds of, he's like a multiple disaster site of, you know, unbidden otherness. And he pushes it farther. He grows the dreadlocks, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's when you think about the idea that, gosh, if only you accommodated us along this dimension, you know, then you would be welcomed with open arms, or then, you know, this, and you think about, you know, that, I ask about bodies partly because, given your visual background, given how central that was to your early life, and your first fiction writing was fantastic. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, both was fantastic in the sense of being very good, but also fantastic in the sense of being just reality-defining. And
there were a lot of fantastic elements. I mean, it was like the world was trippy and kept.
So I wonder, you know, being in this environment, being in this kind of biracial, not yet multiracial environment, and being around this kind of tension, and being in this environment that, you know, parents were idealistic, if not exactly utopian. I wonder about Star Trek, and, you know, how it hit you, and how it sort of was that something that.
Well, I didn't watch that much Star Trek when I was a kid. The show for me was The Twilight Zone, which seemed to capture allegories of alienation and, you know, nuclear fear and all kinds of...
And was extremely political.
And was super political, yeah. And that was the one that was more congenial to me. I mean, I did get into Star Trek a little bit, but I didn't... You know what's funny is I think I took its, what you'd say, it's like, you know, Great Society liberal gestures, the sort of socialistic... egalitarian stuff, very much for granted when I first encountered it. I was like, yeah, well, of course the future is going to be like that. We're headed right there.
You really surprised me because I thought you were going to say that you were a savvy kid and you were cynical about
it. I took
them
with a grain of salt. No, the opposite. I was like, that's just a reasonable depiction of the future. Like, national boundaries dissolve and, yeah, you don't even notice
clearly
who's black or Chinese. Yeah. Of course that. You know, that's just like the basic ground you're standing on. And by the time I would have thought twice about it in order to become cynical the way you propose, I think I'd stopped thinking about Star Trek hard at all, or you know, if I ever had. It was just, but to me that was sort of like, because I was also reading, you know, implicitly utopian science fiction. I mean, you know, when you read someone like Arthur C. Clarke, it's very Star Trek-like in a way. You know, he's such a deeply secular positivist. He just is like, of course religion and national difference dissolve.
Arthur
in the
C. Clarke,
I mean,
wasn't very sexy, though. I mean, that's one thing that
sexy.
I wonder about. Yeah. So I mean, so you were drawn to the world builders. You were drawn to the kind of very
when
nerdy.
When I was quite young, and then I found the dystopian world destroyers. You know, J.G. Ballard and Philip K. Dick
and that
Arthur
fit.
C. Clarke got very corny to me immediately, and so did Star Trek. You know, whereas Rod Serling, The Twilight Zone still seemed relevant to, you know, my appetite for the darker kind of written science fiction.
So, I mean, Dissident Gardens feels, you know, free of, I don't want to say gimmicks, but free of the kind of devices that take you out of our reality.
Uh-huh.
It feels historical, it feels gritty, it feels, you know, these were people and places that exist.
Right.
And I wonder, do you miss the world of the fantastic? Because it occurs to me that when you think about science fiction as a genre, I'm sometimes struck by its failure in this sense. If you tell me that you can bend reality and do absolutely anything, this is what you give me? You know what I mean? With so much of it, I mean, sort of these are the scenarios and this is the kind of...
It's hard. It's hard to live up to that promise, as it is in surrealist painting, you know, like 90% of which is like a little Trump Loy trick or something, and then every now and then you really are, you know, Max Ernst will make an, or De Chirico makes an image that does take you to a really another experience. Those are hard materials, hard methods to maximize, you know.
What I'm saying is that I want you to write another science fiction.
Good. Well, I mean, I just did in Chronic City. I think that was a total vision. For me, it's as big a gesture in that direction as I've ever made. And I don't see those things as being off the palette. You know, I'm just adding other kinds of tonalities, other things I can do. But, you know, one of the things is when I've worked without those obvious gestures, and I did it a number of times. I mean, Motherless Brooklyn is the first time in some ways. But the Tourette's, the neurological trippiness of the language, to me, was like the fantastic element in that book. And that's what I've come to see is that I like to work with, a baseline prosaic reality that we all can, you know, that we all, the consensual world, and really evoke it and really make you feel a lot of mundane stuff, like recognition stuff. Oh, yeah, it's really like that. And then also have this field of the dream life or the distorting field of the visionary material in some form that is an equal pressure on the character's experience, something intangible, something esoteric that they believe in as deeply as they believe in this
prosaic. It also speaks to lived experience.
Right.
I think about the inescapable unknowableness of any other person and just the idea of doing something to kind of illustrate
it. That's it. The real contains the unreal. So for me, in a book like Dissident Gardens, just as the neurology and the language was the field of distortion in Motherless Brooklyn, so I didn't need a rocket ship or a werewolf or something in that book. I feel the same way about Dissident Gardens, that ideology and utopianism, the desire to live in another world that's so, you know, the passion, we all glimpse it, but to live oriented that way so totally, you know, that you sign on to the, you know, Communist Party, that is another one of those fields of distortion. It's like the characters are tripping on their
solidarity, a sense of history, the idea of actually being connected to these currents and being on the right side of history.
That is as unreal.
And being the vessels of this.
The idea that you're a vessel of this gigantic, intangible movement that's happening, that you are part of a revolution, even if no one else will believe you, that it's about to come. To me, that's as tripped out as any fantastic vision I could ever have offered. And so it did what I wanted done to these characters and their lives without my having to introduce those other things.
You talked about tonalities and demonstrating your ability to work with a wider palette. And I wonder, what do you think of as your project? I mean, do you think of yourself as having one in terms of just, is it something about a process of education and discovery for yourself? Is it, I mean...
Yeah, well, education is a word I'd probably always flinch from, or edification. I don't, you know, I think we're a very use-oriented culture. Everything's a commodity or has, you know, it's like it's good for you, and books are often sold as if, you know, oh, you'll learn something or you'll be improved by it. But that's not fundamentally what the expressive arts are for, to like fix or improve things. They're to make new things exist that don't exist. And that's my project. I mean, if I could make it as simple as that, it's to make books that only I could have made and that are utterly surprising, each unto themselves, you know, that nothing I did before could predict this next gesture, and that I myself am in a state of amazement and excitement when I'm making it that proves to me that I'm not just going over old ground or shooting fish in a barrel. The exploration is its own, you know, value. And with the result, you hope, of, you know, leaving an artifact behind as evidence of your exploration that is, you know, thoroughly fascinating, involving, consternating, you know, but that can make people feel an experience that, you know, nothing else could produce.
Well, and I also wonder about activating some natural, if buried, if suppressed, tendency towards empathetic imagination, because, you know, it just occurs to me that, you know, your efforts to describe this world that was not something you had personal and direct access to, but specifically the Black New York as portrayed in Dissident Gardens.
In a book like this, and this links it very strongly to Fortress of Solitude specifically, I think there is another value, you're right, that I've added into my baseline wish to make extraordinary artifacts. And that other value is, oh, kind of witnessing. That I want to say, life was lived thus. People really were this way. I know it, and I'm going to make you feel it. And I think in both of that's what takes those two books, this new one and The Fortress of Solitude, and moves them into another place where it's not that I have a, I'm not writing like a historiography or I have some thesis about history or the city that I'm trying to convince you of. There's no answer, but that just I'm trying to produce evidence, witnessing evidence that life, these kinds of lives have very recently been lived, even if we don't know how to name it or talk about it easily.
Thank you very much for joining me.
My pleasure.
Yeah.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.